The Guardian.
When you think back to school and chemistry lessons, what do you remember? Maybe it was the lab coats, maybe it was the experiments, maybe it was the equations or learning about electrons. But of course, no chemistry lesson would be complete without a poster of the periodic table of the chemical elements plastered on the wall. It's one of the most recognisable icons of science, and this year it turns 150 years old.
Happy birthday!
We celebrate by turning back the clocks to 1869, when a Russian chemist called Dmitri Mendeleev developed the periodic system, having built on the work of countless others.
What made Mendeleev's discovery different is that not only he found a new way to order the elements, but he immediately realized he had found something that was useful for the whole of the community of chemistry.
And we ask whether, 150 years later, the periodic table as we know it may be in jeopardy as chemists are beginning to find elements that just don't fit Mendeleev's mould.
It's going to be very interesting because the shape of the periodic table might not hold up for these new elements.
I'm Nicola Davis. This is Science Weekly.
Hi, is that Bridget?
Yes, hi.
This is my producer, Greya.
How are you?
I'm great, Greya. Hi, nice to hear you.
And this is Brigitte.
So I'm Brigitte van Tiggelen. I am a historian of science, or historian of chemistry, rather. And I am affiliated with the Science History Institute, which is a foundation in Philadelphia that focuses on the preservation and the sharing of the history of chemistry, engineering, and the life sciences.
Together, they looked at the role Mendeleev played in coming up with the periodic table. Of course, a lot of chemists had previously tried to come up with a way to categorise the chemical elements with varying degrees of success, and Mendeleev built upon this knowledge to come up with a system we know and love today.
...is the fact that Mendeleev's attempt came in a context where a lot of chemists already were trying to classify the elements in a, I would say, teachable way, in a way that would make sense not only to practitioners but also to newcomers. In the case of Mendeleev, he had been in Germany, or the German states. He's back, he's in St. Petersburg. He's back in 1861. And then in 67, he becomes a professor at the university. And as a professor, first thing you do is prepare your teaching. And so he starts a new textbook.
Brigitte says that back then, many lecturers would write their own textbooks. And in fact, Mendeleev wrote several. But he kept coming up against a problem. In what order should he present the elements?
This was not the first time this question was asked by a teacher of chemistry, of course, as you might imagine. But what made Mendeleev's discovery different is that not only he found a new way to order the elements, but he immediately realized he had found something that was useful for the whole of the community of chemistry, not just his students, not just his lecture room.
How did he arrange them?
He had, for each element, a list of properties. Among these properties that were characteristic of the element was the atomic weight. Since it's always different from one element to another, I mean, each element has a specific atomic weight, he thought, okay, let's organize them by increasing atomic weight.
Back then, chemists used a system devised in the early 1800s by a Brit called John Dalton, the atomic weight. The atomic weight, perhaps a little confusingly, is not really the weight of an atom in the traditional sense, as we might generally think of it. Instead, it's the relative weight of an average atom of an element. Decades later, Mendeleev used Dalton's table of atomic weights to rank elements, but he also used a second method of classification, grouping elements by their properties.
So once you order an increase of atomic weight, you've got a line. But then to get a table, you have to find similarities. And he observed that several families emerged, families that were actually already known, like the alkali or the alkaline earth or the halogens. But he extended the idea to all elements. And he took, for instance, the type of oxides they were producing to organize the elements in a table.
So not only did Mendeleev organize his elements around their atomic weight, but also arrange them by their sort of similar properties. And I believe he also left gaps for new elements to be found as well.
He did indeed. Of course, these gaps were approximate until we had the atomic number, because once you have the atomic number, you know exactly how many elements will come into the system. But he indeed left gaps, but others did too. He also made predictions. Some were very successful and are very well known. When those elements he had predicted, not only that they existed, not only their atomic weight, but also their chemical properties. This was to him the proof that he had not only devised a system, but he was uncovering a law, a periodic law. And those elements were found in the 70s and mid-80s, and they are usually credited for making Mendeleev such a successful discoverer of the periodic table.
Back in the 19th century, scientists weren't really clear what was going on at the subatomic level, and so finally deciphering this was the next important step in the periodic table's history. Because without knowing what atoms are made of, we wouldn't have the atomic number we use to order the periodic table today.
The first step was to acknowledge that the atoms of each element had a specific number of electrons. So that was the first atomic number, so to speak. Since the atom is neutral, you have the same number of electrons and protons. And by the time we are in 1911, 1912, there are two roots, so to speak, that come to the atomic number. It's the fact that on the one hand, there were atomic models by Ernst Rutherford or Niels Bohr that were trying to make sense of all the observations. But the problem was to link theory with experimental evidence. And this is where Henry Moseley came in 1913, when he was able to stress and to demonstrate that there is an unequivocal link between the X-ray spectra of an element and the atomic number. So not only at that time, the atomic number appears like the characteristic, theoretical characteristic of the element, but it also becomes the way to spot new elements. Because if you observe a new X-ray spectra never observed before, you're pretty sure this is a new element.
In 1916, Henry Moseley was experimenting with electrons at the University of Manchester. He would fire electrons at various different elements. When he did, the element's atoms would gain energy when they were hit. Eventually, these atoms would lose this energy, and in doing so, give off X-rays. Importantly, the wavelengths of these X-rays could be measured. When Henry Moseley did this, he found there was a relationship between the wavelength of the X-rays and the position of the element in the periodic table. Moseley's work was crucial in the development of the idea of the atomic number. This reflects the number of positively charged subatomic particles we now call protons. And that brings us to where we are today.
Back in Mendeleev's day, we only knew of 60 or so elements. How many do we know of today?
Officially, there's 118 that have been accepted by IUPAC, the International Union of Pure and Applied Chemistry. And I'm pretty sure several laboratories in the world are pursuing the next elements.
So there may be more elements to come yet.
There may be more elements, and I would recommend you to ask the question to a working chemist.
Well, that's good, because we've got Peter Wuthers for the second half of this program, so we'll make
that's
sure we
excellent.
Fit him.
Peter Wuthers is a chemist at the University of Cambridge, and to me is something of a chemistry legend. In fact, it's the textbook that he helped co-author that I studied during my undergraduate degree. After the break, Peter and I talk about the future of the periodic table, how we're finding new elements, and why that could cause the periodic table to break, thanks to Einstein's theory of special relativity.
It's as some of the electrons within the atoms are accelerated to very high speeds, their properties change from the other electrons that we have in the lighter atoms, so they become slightly different, and the energy levels are not quite what we expected before.
We'll be back in a few ticks.
The Voice Lab from The Guardian.
Hey, do you ever want a quick catch-up on the news headlines first thing in the morning while you're making breakfast or getting dressed? Well, if you have a Google Assistant or Google Home, we can help with that. The Guardian Briefing is an experiment from the Voice Lab, which in under 2 minutes brings you up to speed with what you need to know about the day's top stories. We'll make sure you don't miss a thing. To listen at any time, just say, "Hey Google, speak to the Guardian Briefing."
Welcome back to Science Weekly. I'm Nicola Davis. Before the break, we celebrated the periodic table's 150th birthday by looking back through its history, from work by Mendeleev to elucidation of the subatomic structure of the atom, research which gave us what's known as the atomic number, which is how we organise the periodic table today. Now we turn to the periodic table's future. It's lasted all this time, but could the discovery of new elements jeopardise a chemist's best friend?
My name is Peter Wuthers, and I'm a teaching fellow at the Department of Chemistry in the University of Cambridge.
Fantastic. I spoke with Peter recently and started by focusing on the discovery of new elements. In previous centuries, famous chemists like Joseph Priestley and Antoine Lavoisier discovered new elements at the lab bench using some fairly basic equipment. But today, most new elements are made with some seriously sophisticated kit, as Peter explains.
So you need to look at the structure of the atom itself. So an atom is made up, in the heart of the atom, in the nucleus, we have positively charged protons and neutrons, which have no charge at all, and we have electrons whizzing around outer parts of the atom. And so what makes one element different from another is the number of protons that we have in the nucleus, which is usually balanced in the neutral atom by the same number of negatively charged electrons. So that's what makes one element different from another. Now, it's possible to change one atom into another by adding more of those protons and neutrons. So that's how an element is changed into another. You fire particles, smaller particles of one nucleus, at another larger one and hope that they sort of stick together to give you a new unknown element.
So this is quite interesting, because the elements that Lavoisier and Priestley were discovering, these are found naturally around us and are reasonably abundant. Is that right?
Yes, that's right. I mean, various abundances, of course. I mean, so there's obviously oxygen, which is plentiful, iron, silicon. So see, these are some of the most common elements. Then there are ones that are far more rare, so such as, you know, gold, for instance, platinum, palladium. But then there are also, say, elements that are radioactive. So uranium is radioactive, but it has a very long half-life. This means the time that it takes to gradually decay is, well, billions of years, which means that when the elements are initially formed in our region of space in the solar system here, we've still got some of this residual uranium left over. It hasn't yet gone. Whereas some of the ones that have shorter lifespans have since disappeared. So those are the ones that we can't find around us any longer.
So when it comes to these artificially produced elements and you're bombarding them with particles to make these new elements, how long do they hang around for? And how long do they have to hang around for to actually be called a new element? Is there some sort of line in the sand?
Well, there is. It's very short, though. I mean, so the lives of these things are typically very small indeed. They can be, I mean, as you get to the heavier and heavier atoms, they tend to be even more short-lived. So fractions of seconds. But there is a definition. These nuclei, so that the heart of the atom, needs to exist long enough that it could set up the sort of the electrons around it, which is one of the key features of an atom.
And why are they so short-lived? You sort of mentioned about radioactive elements, but just talk me through why these artificially produced elements can be so transient.
Well, it's to do with the stability of this nucleus. So there are a set number of protons and neutrons, and with the really largest heavy atoms, they tend to fall apart into smaller components. So, for instance, in radioactive decay, the emission of an alpha particle, so alpha decay, is actually where a helium nucleus is ejected from the nucleus of the larger atom. So this means it's actually losing some protons, two protons and two neutrons during this process. And so if we looked at our periodic table, during this radioactive decay where an alpha particle is emitted, we move sort of from where we started two places to the left. So we go to a lower atomic number, which is the number of the protons that the nucleus has.
And these artificially produced elements, did they ever sort of occur naturally? I mean, I know that's how we produce them now, but you said, you know, that some naturally occurring elements might just not be around anymore. I just wonder whether we're kind of recapitulating the past or whether these are elements that would never have existed without our big machines.
Well, no. So you need extreme conditions to make these nuclei, and this is what we're trying to reproduce now. But of course, these are the same extreme conditions that occur, for instance, when a supernova is exploding or in the heart of a neutron star or something. So there are places in the universe where these elements may be momentarily created, but if they don't last long enough for life to evolve and observe them, then we would never have known that they were made, if you see what I mean.
Some of these heavier elements only exist for a fraction of a second, but amazingly, Peter tells me you can still probe their properties.
It gets harder, I think. I think there would be a limit, I should think, about how easy it would be to measure some of these. But people are certainly trying to synthesize more elements. So there are a number of places around the world where this research is going on, starting with elements 119, 120. But it's going to be very interesting because the shape of the periodic table might not hold up for these new elements.
Why is that? Why is it that might cause a bit of a problem?
Well, at the moment, I mean, the classic shape of our periodic table that you might find on the walls at school, there are the different blocks. So we have on the left-hand side, there's a sort of a tall couple of columns called the S block. On the right-hand side, there's a block called the P block. And so, for instance, we find the transition metals usually squished in between those, and then the so-called F block right at the bottom underneath the whole table. But as there is a pattern here, and that is that as you move from the left to the right across the periodic table, we're adding one proton in the nucleus of the atom and one electron at the same time in the neutral element. But this pattern might not quite work. So, for instance, you might find as you're moving across that you're jumping from one position to another as you're adding one proton. So we might not have the nice pattern that we have at the moment.
And what's behind that? Is that just because these are very heavy elements that things start to go a bit awry?
No, it's to do with the energy levels of the electrons in the atom. So this is what determines the chemical properties of an atom. And of course, the periodic table is about bringing some sense to all of the atoms that we have. And this is so they share elements in the same columns, for instance, share similar chemical reactions. And this is due to the electron configurations that they have, how the electrons are arranged in their shells and in their subshells. But this pattern that's nice and ordered so far is beginning to change for the very heavy elements. And this is because, all of the energy levels of these electrons are sort of, the order is changing due to relativistic effects, which is all very exciting.
That sounds like it might have something to do with Einstein. Can you tell me a bit more about that?
It is. It's as some of the electrons within the atoms are accelerated to very high speeds, their properties change from the other electrons that we have in the lighter atoms. So they become slightly different and the energy levels are not quite what we expected before.
So talking about these relativistic effects, it sounds like they have an impact on the energy levels within the atom and therefore sort of how the electrons are distributed. Is that right?
Distributed and in actually the chemical reactivities that these atoms were to display. So for instance, one of the classic experiment that you chuck a little piece of sodium on water and it fizzes round, and then you use potassium and it's even more reactive. So as you go down the group, the elements get more and more reactive. And that's because it becomes easier and easier to remove this outermost electron that these atoms have. And so we come to the bottom, cesium. This is a non-radioactive element, and it's incredibly reactive. But then underneath there, there's one more. There's francium. Now, you might expect that francium should be even more reactive, even easier to remove that electron. But these relativistic effects actually mean it's slightly harder to remove that one electron. And so actually, francium isn't quite as reactive as cesium. So this is where the periodic table is not quite doing what we thought it should, because there's another factor that we need to take into account.
And these effects might become even more pronounced when you get into the super heavy element.
Yes, that's absolutely right.
It's crazy to think that the discovery of these heavier elements could break the periodic table. The reason is that the very heaviness of these atoms means their electrons move at really high speeds. That affects their orbits, and in turn, the electrons' ability to be shared or given away in a reaction. In other words, these heavier elements behave differently to how one might expect. But why would we want to find them anyway?
Well, I think to some extent they might be chemical curiosities, although there are some artificial elements now that play a very important part in our lives. The classic one, for instance, being the element americium, which is artificial, which has a relatively short life so that there isn't any found naturally on Earth. But this is now used in smoke detectors, for instance, which is quite remarkable. But that one is relatively stable. So the newer ones, it's difficult to see how they might have a use. But then part of the problem is it's possible to prepare different isotopes of the same element. So remember, the key thing that differentiates one element from another is the number of positively charged protons that the element has. So that's unique for a particular element. But the numbers of neutrons could vary slightly. And so we get sort of heavier elements, heavier atoms of the same element. So these are called isotopes. Now, it's possible that some of the elements that we've made so far and actually do have very short half-lives, well, it's possible that there might be other isotopes of these that have much longer half-lives, and that would be very exciting.
I just wonder what you think the future holds for the periodic table. I mean, it's quite a useful tool for chemists. I just wonder whether you think, you know, we sort of hinted that it might not quite stand up if we have further elements, but do you think the periodic table, generally speaking, is going to stand the test of time?
Oh yes, absolutely. I love it. The periodic table is, I mean, it's so useful as is at the moment. So yeah, I mean, there are questions about some of these very, very heavy elements, but you know, the real questions, first of all, is, you know, are we going to be able to observe these in any way? Are they going to have, you know, much use, much meaning to us? But so there would be some odd placements within the periodic table, perhaps, if it's ever possible to synthesize some of these even heavier elements. But the periodic table, as it stands at the moment, is not wrong, and it's incredibly useful. So it's not going to be obsolete, I think.
Well, it's been fantastic talking to you, Peter. Like I said, it's always exciting to talk to somebody that wrote the textbooks that I slogged over all those years ago. So it's great. I remember my tutor, if I didn't know the answer, saying, "It is on page 134 in Claydon," and I had to rush off and go and find it. So yeah, very, very good stuff. And thanks for talking through all of this.
Okay,
I'll leave you in peace. Thanks
Lovely.
So much, Peter.
Thanks,
bye then.
Bye-bye. Bye.
Many thanks to Peter Wuthers and Brigitte van Tiegeling for joining us in celebrating the periodic table's 150th birthday. The producer was Greer Jackson, I'm Nicola Davis, and until next time, goodbye.
For more great podcasts from The Guardian, just go to theguardian.com/podcasts.